Hi, and welcome to today's meeting of Book Hoarders Anonymous. Let's all begin by introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Shannon, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's, month's, year's edition of Book Hoarders Anonymous, episode 31. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shannon.
And we haven't been with you in a long time, but we are back, and we've got two books to talk about this time.
Woo!
Yay! At least I enjoyed them, good books.
And very different books.
Yeah, and very different books. And first of all, I thought we'd mention some listener mail, because we did get listener mail, and that's exciting.
Yay, listener mail!
Thank you to Judy for emailing us and letting us know how much she enjoyed the David Baldacci Christmas Train book. And I'm glad that it worked for somebody. I really am. Yeah.
I think, David Baldacci is a popular author for a reason, and just because he's probably not an author I will seek out again, you know, doesn't mean anything except that I don't happen to share those particular tastes.
Yeah,
that's okay.
I like thrillers, so at some point I will get out of my Jonathan Kellerman fix and go to someone else's thrillers. And I'm thinking, I have one David Baldacci book in my borrowed wish list that's been there and just is aching to be read. So that may be one of my picks. I got out of my Jonathan Kellerman fix, and now I'm on to a Faye Kellerman fix, which kind of is similar but not, since they're married and all. And her books are a little bit different, but fascinating in their way, and of course part of a series. And so once I get over that, I may go and read that book, because it's been on my wish list for like 2 years. So it needs to be read.
Yes.
Speaking of reading and books, why don't we start off, since we've got two books, by talking about our first book, which was Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury.
And which was a book that has been the topic of many a high school reading English class. I never read it in high school. This was the first time I'd ever encountered it. I think it'll be interesting because you really enjoyed it, but I didn't.
I did. And I find that this book gives me something new every time I read it. Now, it's one of those books that if I had to read it in high school, I would not have enjoyed it. Because it would have felt like I was being forced to read it. I don't know how to explain this, but there are some books that just, when you're reading them, they're very dense. And so I think it's one of those books that if I had read it in high school, it would have felt like the teachers, since it's one of those books that, you know, you can get a lot of different things out of it. And teachers would probably say, well, you should have gotten, you know how teachers are, this, 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 and this out of it. And I would probably have said, oh, well, I got this, 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 and this, the other thing out of it. Tried to have been forced into a mold by it. But I didn't read it in high school. I stumbled across it literally several years ago, and I'm not even sure exactly where. But it was one of those things that kind of fell into my lap, and I knew that I wanted to start reading more of Ray Bradbury's work after reading some of his short stories and being completely, floored by them. They're so wonderful. Except if you download the Machineries of Joy version from Bard, which is terrible, because the narrator is terrible, but that's a whole other story. I knew that I wanted to read more of his work after reading also the Martian Chronicles, which are really good. So when I read it, I thought, wow, this is really amazing, because imagine a world where no one read. And Fahrenheit 451, if you don't know, is the temperature at which paper and books burn, apparently. I don't know. I haven't tested this out for myself. I'm not like the guy on Cyber who decides he wants to write a computer code to start fires and printers over the internet and stuff. I'm not a pyromaniac. So I didn't test this out myself. But apparently, that is the temperature at which books and paper will burn. I found it fascinating. You know, firemen in this case are being used to burn books, because all books have ideas that run against, you know, what society is working on. And I guess Ray Bradbury, you know, what ideals society has. And so the society of this particular alternate future is basically focused on media and advertising and television, although he doesn't call it television.
But it's
the same kind of deal. And so in virtual reality and other sorts of, you know, media things, you know, in other words, taking the media craze to an all new high. And I find it interesting that while people cannot read books, they can read scripts in order to participate in these like virtual reality plays. So there's this line there, and you know, that people can't cross. So our main protagonist is a fireman, and he goes around burning books all the time, and gets a little bit fed up with it and actually starts reading the books and realizes that reading is interesting and why should I be forbidden this type of thing? And the lengths to which he will go to satisfy his urge to read, basically. And so Guy Montag is our protagonist. I find it interesting that there's not a whole lot of character development. Like, a lot of the other characters are just really shallow. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of disappointed by that. But I think that part of it was the point of the book. Ray Bradbury wanted us to concentrate on one person's view of, you know, society through this person's lens and how they, you know, how they observed and he observed and perceived things. And most of the other characters, especially those that did not read, were just very shallow and underdeveloped, like his wife, who I wanted to slap around several times. But, hey, you know, can't always get what you want, as the song says. But I liked it. So I want to hear more about your views on the book, because if you didn't enjoy it, I'm real interested to know why.
Well, I think, you know, again, one of those things that if I'd studied it in high school, like that we all get various things out of it. And I think I kind of felt a little bit like I was being harangued at. Like, I get it. He thinks that television is terrible and that it's rotting our brains. And it certainly didn't do any favors to poor Guy Montag's wife. And I kind of felt like I was listening to some old guy be like, "You kids with your newfangled technologies, get off my lawn." So I
get that.
Yeah, it was just a little, I don't know. It definitely felt a bit more like a harangue than an honest attempt at storytelling. Although there were good parts of it, like, you know, when Montag does, you know, finally actually get to be proactive instead of just being like, I'm vaguely unhappy with my life. Like,
what's up with that?
Like, once he starts moving and doing things on his own, then it becomes a lot more interesting. But and it's not a very long book, so but there was a lot of him just kind of being like,
ho hum, life is sort of bad and I don't know why. And yeah, and I think,
why is my wife vaguely suicidal?
I think that this book, and I understand completely why you think it's a harangue, I looked at it as a conversion. And in the general conversion experience, now, people think of conversion with religion, but you can get conversion over ideas, too. Like, you know, espousing an idea. Mm-hmm. In the conversion experience, there are different stages. And the first stage is, life sucks and I don't know why. And as you go along, I mean, and psychologists are right and sociologists are right to a certain extent. A lot of times there is no one as fanatical as a convert.
Right.
You get someone behind a cause or behind a religious belief or behind something, and it's new to them and they are passionate about it. And so, and they've been trying to look for a channel for their passion, you know, or unhappy feelings or whatever. And then they find this thing that they can channel their passions into. And that's why I was sort of a little more lenient, because I think that I kind of understand that he's not preaching at us. It's like from the point of view of this particular like archetypal character who's, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here, but this is how I took it. And so that's why I wasn't really mad about it. But I can certainly understand how you would think that, and I agree completely that the first part of like, I'm very vaguely unhappy is a lot less interesting than when he actually starts, you said, being proactive and doing things and taking action. And I think the thing that, and it's like the conversion experience, the second or is it third stage after the vaguely unhappy is sort of epiphany, and his epiphany came when Clarice committed suicide. Mm-hmm. Or no, committed suicide? What am I talking about? Different book. My bad.
Oh, yeah.
When they moved away
when they left.
When they disappeared. And so his epiphany came when that whole family disappeared, and he was like, oh, now I finally figured it out. And then he started, you know, you can do one of two things with an epiphany. You can either channel it into something positive and good, or you can channel it into something negative and terrible and you know, be brave or cowardly, in other words, or go inward with it. And he went outward with it and started acting on it. And I saw it as being a very sort of like brave thing that he did. Obviously, converting other people wasn't working. And so he had to, you know, was forced to flee, but eventually, you know, did that and found a small group of others who felt the way he did. And they're going to start their own crusade. And I know that, you know, like I mean, I get the whole, it feels preachy and it was a harangue, but,
also,
enjoyed that.
Like the other thing is that like, that also that I felt like I didn't necessarily need, like, I'm not his audience because like, I don't watch a whole lot of TV. I don't think I'm particularly, I mean, I guess we all are to some extent, but, you know, like, I do, like, obviously, I'm reading this book.
I like to read, so why are you preaching at me?
Right.
Yeah. And I get that, too, to some extent. But I
see what you're saying, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, people can have different opinions about this book. Some people really hate it. Some people love it. Some people just, whatever. But it is one of those like classic science fiction books that people read in school a lot. And after his death, there was a big spike in purchases of Fahrenheit 451. So we thought that we would read that. And I hope that some of you enjoyed it. And if you didn't, then please tell us your thoughts, regardless of what they are. We'd love to hear them. And I think, I mean, I don't have many more thoughts about it. I mean, it was a short book. It was kind of, I mean, I thought it was good, but at the same time, I'm not going to wax rhapsodic because not a whole lot happens.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we can't give too much away without spoiling the whole book. He finds out that books are great and he has to flee the government and he goes off and starts his own book crusade, and that's really it. I do think one of my main criticisms of the book is there's not a whole lot of plot.
Yeah.
it doesn't really go anywhere. But again, short book, and he doesn't have a whole lot. I mean, I guess he could have made it longer, but I don't know that I would have liked it if it was any longer.
No.
To be honest, I mean...
it's about the right length.
Yeah. So, anyway, let us know what you think at Book Hoarders on Twitter and BHA Podcast.
At gmail.com.
And now we're going to move on to talk about what we read over the past month and a half. You want to start off?
Okay. Well, I've been reading sort of like a weird combination of things. I've been reading lots of classic children's literature, and I read a Stephen King book.
All right.
I read Hearts in Atlantis by Stephen King, which I think I got mixed up with The Dreamcatcher in my head. I thought that I thought that Hearts in Atlantis was about four friends that went and hunted aliens, but
that's,
I think that's
The Dreamcatcher. And I couldn't get beyond the first chapter because it was so disgusting. But anyway, Hearts in Atlantis, what did you think? I haven't read it.
Hearts in Atlantis was kind of a mixed bag. It wasn't one of Stephen King's better books, but it wasn't one of his worst ones either. It's four interconnected short stories about this group of people that all kind of vaguely knew each other in 1960, and it's all about the 60s, which is kind of Stephen King's thing.
Oh, cool.
And the first book, the first story is the longest, and it has a lot of homages to The Dark Tower, so if you haven't read The Dark Tower, like I haven't read The Dark Tower, it's not going to mean a whole lot to you. And you'll be sitting there throughout a lot of sections of the story being like, okay, what are they talking about? I don't understand.
Oh, I've read The Dark Tower. Now I'm interested now.
Yeah. So you might like it better than I do.
I may.
But the other three stories I liked a lot better. Like Hearts in Atlantis is about the title story is about a boy who is in college with the childhood friend of the kid in the first story. And they like the war in Vietnam is starting and so are like the first beginnings of student protests and the narrator is on scholarship and he kind of realizes that like, hey, maybe he shouldn't be goofing around because if he goofs around, he might have to go serve in Vietnam, which is, you know, not being such a great thing. And so it's all kind of like Vietnam kind of colors the rest of the book and like how it affects the different people's lives. And it's, like I said, the first story didn't really work for me very well, even though it's has like a lot of Stephen King's classic things. It's about kids and he writes kids really well. And you know, about like losing of innocence and things like that. But I didn't understand the Dark Tower references. So hopefully you'll like it better than I did. But the rest of the stories I liked a lot.
I'm going to read that now. For some reason, I had a digital print copy of the book, and somehow I got it in German, which doesn't help me at all. So at some point, I'm going to have to track down an English version and read it. Yeah, I don't know how that happened. It was a complete accident. And I opened the copy, and I'm like, what language is this? This is not English. I understood Hearts in Atlantis and Stephen King, and that was about it. Like, what?
The Bard narration is really interesting. It's read by somebody named Jeremy Gage, who I'm not really that familiar with. But And he was an odd choice because he has this very gentle, like, sort of prissy way of speaking. but he makes it work.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, some of those choices.
You can read it in English if you want to.
Oh, good. That was just really bizarre. Okay, what else have you read?
What else have I read? I read the other really awesome discovery. I've been reading a lot of children's literature, like I said, and I recently read The Wind in the Willows, which I had never read.
One of my faves. Oh my goodness.
I think I had like absorbed Wind in the Willows cultural osmosis. You know, like it's. I'm sure that there was a movie.
I think
and I think it's one of those things like the Adventures of Mr. Toad is the kind of thing that like gets retold a lot in children's books. So I kind of knew some of it somewhere, but I don't think I'd ever actually read the book. And it was just delightful. I didn't really go in for that kind of thing as a kid because I was never really like, I liked talking animals, but I wanted to read about people and there were no girls in it.
Yeah, I was sort of the same way when I was a kid too, but I read this when I was in high school for the first time. And I agree. It was delightful. The talking animals and they're like, but they're anthropomorphized and it was just so cool.
And it's a very cozy, it's a cozy book. It's like, you know, just the kind of thing you want to, when I was reading it, I would dole myself out a chapter or so during my commutes because it was just not the kind of book that it sort of wanted to be savored. And I think that the friendship between the rat and the mole is one of the cutest things I have ever read.
Oh, it is. I think it's so cute. And I just love the mole. I just love the beginning when he's like in his house and he's like, oh, I hate house cleaning. And it's just like, that is just so me.
So then he goes and has adventures.
Exactly. Instead of cleaning his house. And there was a wonderful version of this done in audio by The Mind's Eye, like a long time ago.
Oh,
and The Mind's Eye, I actually have, now I'm not a fan of abridged books, but I did make an exception for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy that were produced by The Mind's Eye because they were They're fantastic. If you can get past the fact that they give the elves these weird voices that don't really work, they make them sound sort of like this. And that really doesn't work, and it's weird. But if you can get past that, it's like it's cool. Like it has ambient sounds. You know, if they're outside, it has like nature sounds. It has music. It has all the characters have a voice, like a different person doing a voiceover. Some of them are a little cartoonish. Like I said, if you can get past the little cartoonish, there's not a whole lot of cartoonish voices. They're really cool. And they did one of the Wind in the Willows as well that a friend of mine had. And it was the same kind of deal, like sounds. Like, you know, when Mr. Toad goes in the car, in the motor car, they have an old car, you know, driving along. And, you know, nature sounds when the storm and the rain and the doorbell when people come to call on the rat and mole, you know, ringing doorbell. And it's just really cool. And I don't know if it's around anymore. I mean, I don't know if the Lord of the Rings trilogy is around anymore. I have the cassettes. That's how old how old I am. I have all of these on cassettes. I don't have Wind in the Willows, but I have the rest. And I've been debating on whether to digitize them. Like I said in a earlier podcast, digitizing cassettes is a lot of trouble if you don't have a special USB cassette recorder, which I don't. And so I've been debating on it, but I still have them. And they're still great. And they gave me a lot of comfort on trips when I was in high school and my parents and I would go to Indiana, because that's a 12 hours, a long 12-hour trip, especially if you do it in one day. So yeah, they had one of the Wind in the Willows, and I think there are a lot of other children's books that particular company did. So I'd encourage people who are interested in that kind of thing to check them out. I know it's called The Mind's Eye, and that's about all I know, but they're probably still around. Anyway, sorry about that. So, I rambled on. What else did you read?
So the other things I read, because after I read The Wind in the Willows, I really kind of wanted to stay in that classic children's book mindset. So I reread Little Women, and then I read the sequel, and it was sort of funny because the bard narrator is Patricia Beaudry, who sounds an awful lot like Flo Gibson, who narrated Wind in the Willows. And my colleague at work says that they are not the same person, but you could fool me.
Yeah, they're really not, but they do sound a lot alike. You're right.
So Little Women was like, I was a little unsure, because the last time I read any Louisa May Alcott, I read this short little collection of Christmas stories she wrote. And it was clearly something she wrote to make some money, because they were not good. they were really treacly and super sweet. And like, it was one of those things where the moral was like, you'd get like two pages of story, and then there would be like 15 more. Let me tell you what you're supposed to get out of this. And you know, I couldn't imagine any actual children being like, yes, actually, let's have more of this. So it kind of tainted my experience with Little Women. I was a little worried it would be like that, but no, it was still the same really good book that I remembered. And, I reread it because a friend of mine had been telling me that had asked me if I'd ever read Little Men, which is the one that comes after Little
Women. After Good Wives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After Good Wives. And, I had not. And she said, well, you really should, because it's like it will meet all of your English or your awesome boarding school needs. and I, you know, being a fan of Harry Potter, I like awesome boarding schools.
I do, too.
So I read it and was really quite charmed.
Yeah, I love boarding schools. The book that I remember, well, there's a set of books that I remember from when I was younger, and they're like, you know, Carolyn Keene, who wrote the Nancy Drew mysteries, or that particular pen name was used for another set of mysteries, and they were the Louise and Jean Dana mysteries, and these were twins who went to a boarding school in, I don't know, Massachusetts or someplace, called Starhurst Academy or Starhurst School or something, Starhurst something. And I just remember that was the first experience I had with, like, boarding school literature, and they were fun. not all the mysteries took place at the boarding school, but, you know, you had the quirky characters and the headmistresses and all that kind of thing that were kind of the backdrop to a lot of the setting. And I remember that being my introduction to boarding school literature, and it was a load of fun.
But yeah, Little Men definitely will meet your boarding school needs. And I was really kind of, I don't, like, sometimes I've read books about, like, the children of characters that in beloved works of literature and been thinking, like, well, you know, like, these people are, like, no, oh, yay, now I get to watch Anne Shirley be a grown-up. That's not what I signed up for.
Yeah.
Mm. And there was some of that, but I thought that she did very well with her boys, and I got the feeling that she enjoyed, like, she just really seemed like she enjoyed herself in this, like, the writer was, mm-hmm. it wasn't as didactic at all as even parts of Little Women, and the characters are really well drawn, and it's fairly delightful, and I even really liked that she had a couple of disabled characters in there, although
that's cool.
Tragically, spoiler alert, in the third book, like, they both die of being disabled.
Whoops.
So, which was a little upsetting. But it's, I enjoyed it. I thought it was, even a little more fun than Little Women, which really surprised me.
Anything and else then, to add to the mix?
And then my last one I want to mention is, like, my nonfiction book for the month is, I'm reading a biography of Roald Dahl called Storyteller. Speaking of classic children's literature, and he led a really interesting life. He's only in his 20s at the moment, right now where I'm at, which is like 3 hours into this 26-hour book. But he was apparently like a British spy during World War II.
Yes, he was.
So, and then he went on to write children's books, and mm-hmm. I think that that's awesome.
Yeah.
And so I'm enjoying reading about him.
Oh, good. Let's see. My reads, if you don't have any more.
Nope, go ahead.
Okay, so I read, my nonfiction book is Why People Believe Weird Things by Michael Shermer, and it's basically, it talks about people who believe things that are definitely outside of the mainstream, and why they hang on to their beliefs despite the fact that they're not supported, you know, by science or logic half the time. And we're talking about people who believe in, you know, that the moon landing was filmed in Hollywood, and people who have had near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences, and people who have scientific beliefs, like they're scientists, but they have these weird sort of, well, I will say weird because a couple of them are sort of fringe beliefs about the nature of the universe and how it's and how it works. Also people who believe that race is a factor in intelligence, and he even tackles the creation science people. And this guy is the editor of Skeptic magazine, or was in the late 90s. And so, of course, he's skeptical about everything. And it was very enlightening for me. I really did enjoy it, even though I may not agree with everything he said, obviously, and how he, you know, logically or not, refutes all of the, you know, theories, that fringe theories that he's talking about. It was very enlightening and interesting to read about why people believe these things. I mean, Holocaust denial theories, and, you know, the Bell Curve book. He talks about that book that was written in the 90s that basically said that African Americans were less intelligent than whites, and you could statistically prove it. And it's a quite lengthy book. I mean, for nonfiction, and for me, it's almost 400 pages. And so that was, you know, that was my nonfiction read. I liked it a lot. I don't know that I'm going to tackle any of his other writing that he's done, at least not right at the moment, because it's just very intense. I mean, you have to think critically through the whole book, and it's very much based on, you know, logical thinking and analysis. And so, you know, it's kind of one of those intense ones that you have to pay attention to. But that said, I thought it was good. and well written and very well researched. Another book, let's see, I'm trying to think of the, The Butter Did It by Phyllis Richards. This is a new series for me. It's about this food critic who starts solving mysteries. And this one sort of drops into her lap because it involves her ex-husband and her daughter and, you know, family members. And she really writes food columns as a living, but she's trying to play amateur sleuth to, you know, save people from, you know, being charged with murder and stuff. And it is based on, I mean, somehow the solution to the mystery involves food in some way. The author was a professional chef before she became a novelist. And so it if I recall, it did have a couple of recipes in it. But I read it just after coming off of a very intense period of study. And it was nice to read that because it was not too intense. It was not really cotton candy either, but it was just the right mixture of both, and I liked it. So I may try some of this other person's work. I'm not sure. It was a new author for me, and to some extent, the mystery was formulaic, but it was still fun, especially reading about the food industry itself, because she weaves a lot of those kinds of things into it. Read, let's see, Grasshopper Jungle by Andrew Smith. And this book I read because it was in the reading of it was inspired by one of the hosts of the Book Riot podcast, Rebecca Shinsky, made some kind of comment on Twitter that unfortunately I didn't look up the whole Twitter banter before the podcast. But she made some sort of comment that the Andrew Smith should really make more, you know, better drawn female characters in his books. And he has a history. This is an author who writes primarily for young adult teenage males. So that's kind of the market he writes for. And he came out and he had an interview in which he was asked this particular question, why are your women in your books kind of flat and boring, basically. And this was before her tweet came out. But he answered, basically, that he grew up in a family of all boys, and so when he got married, he had a 17-year-old daughter. Well, I don't know if they were married. I'm kind of assuming. But he has a 17-year-old daughter, so he really doesn't know all that much about women. Now, that was when Rebecca Shinsky chimed in and said, that's not a good enough excuse, and she got a lot of Twitter flack for that. So anyway, they spent a whole Book Riot podcast, well, not a whole podcast, but at least half of it, talking about that, and she was defending what she said, and I don't know. Anyway, Twitter drama. But that aside, it got me interested in reading his books because I'd never read one before, and she had read this one and liked it, and I actually liked it too. That said, she is correct that the female character is like really boring and not very well. I mean, she doesn't really do much. She's kind of ditzy and flighty, and she's this kid's girlfriend. She's, you know, they're both 16. And essentially what happens in the book is that the apocalypse comes because somebody, this kid and his friend unwittingly broke into this office this office that had a lot of old, like, scientific equipment that no one knew the purpose of anymore because the company where it came from had gone out of business. And they broke in, and then these other bullies that were behind them broke in behind them and broke the equipment. And it let loose, it's a long story, but a plague that basically changed most of humanity into 6-foot-tall fighting praying mantises. And they took over the world.
I really hate when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it really sucks, doesn't it? That said, he and his friend figured out what was going on, so they went after the praying mantises with, like, paintball guns, you know, with a special paint in them, to kill them. The book was dark and weird, and it doesn't sound funny, but it was. And it was very amusing, I thought. Not meant to be taken seriously. It was meant to be humorous, and again, it was. But you have to read it in order to get the humor of it. It was like American Pie with apocalypse.
Huh.
I mean, you know, the two boys are the main heroes, and they're trying to be regular teenagers while this apocalypse is going on. And they manage to save their families, and the main character has a girlfriend. They manage to save his girlfriend, who's really flighty and ditzy, and like I said, doesn't do much. So, you know, I kind of agreed that the female characters are really boring, but I thought the book was funny. And I also agree with people who say that he really needs to learn to write better female characters. That's true to a point. But if you're writing for a certain audience, you're going to write what that audience wants. And so that's also true. I think his excuse of not knowing a whole lot about women is kind of like a crappy excuse, but what can you do, you know?
Yeah.
Stephen King has said, write about what you know. But that said, he writes pretty good women overall. He has written some women who are not quite so good, but some, I mean, you know, so well drawn in terms of character development. But they're at least better than those of Andrew Smith. I will say that. That said, I mean, you know, it's not a book I'll read every day, and it's probably not a good book I'm going to go back to anytime soon, but it was a funny sort of read if you want apocalypse humor. And the last book I'll mention was a very serious book. It was called All Who Go Do Not Return by Shulam Dean, whose name I have spelled on Twitter several times. My bad. This book was also recommended by the Book Riot team. I get their new books this week email. I probably shouldn't because I went straight to Kindle and bought it. You know, it was kind of pricey for a Kindle book, but I don't regret that. I was very excited that I could go and, you know, I always get that little thrill when something brand new comes out. And thanks to Amazon and the Kindle
app,
us blind people, we can just have the book right then. And we don't have to wait for somebody to put it into a format that we can read either in Braille or audio. So this was a book about a man who, it's a true story, it's a memoir, so I guess it does count as nonfiction, although it didn't feel like nonfiction when I read it. I mean, it had dialogue, and it moved pretty quickly. About a man who grew up in a Hasidic Jewish community, which is a sect of ultra, I guess, Orthodox Jews. Ultra in the sense that it was kind of cultish. Very cultish, actually. It's a village in New York that's basically devoted to this particular sect, and they, it was almost like a commune. And I think the village is still around. It still exists. All of his children and his wife still live there. But he was expelled for being a heretic after he'd been married for about 15 years. And like I said, very cultish in the sense that, you know, they have an ultimate authority figure that everyone goes to get questions answered. The children are matched with potential spouses by a matchmaker. I mean, you know, not potential. This is who you're going to marry. That's it. You know, you meet about 6 minutes before your wedding and that's your meeting. Really. You don't have any say in the matter. The men are expected to study Torah and the Talmud up until they're in their 20s. And so this creates an interesting dichotomy because you're supposed to be married before, like in your late teens, and start having kids, right? So men are studying. Women are not allowed to work outside the home. So how are you getting fed? These folks are relying on government benefits and they're all very poor. Poverty is just rampant. And they're very insulated because very few of them speak English of any kind because most of them speak Yiddish. And although they learn English in school, it's, you know, they learn to read it rather than speak it. I didn't even think that places like this existed in America, at least this, you know, this, especially with the language barrier, that we're this insulated. And so this was a really educational experience for me. You know, no television, no radio, none of that gets into the community so they can keep secular society out, basically. But yet they rely on social welfare. It's a really paradoxical system. I was very moved by his whole story, which basically concentrates on his one day he listened to the radio, and then that was it. I mean, you know, then it was television, and then he started learning how to program computers and became a programmer for, you know, a large international company. And then after a while, the elect authority figures in the village decided that he was a heretic because he brought home too many strange beliefs, and he didn't attend Sabbath and, you know, Sabbath services and pray like he was supposed to. And he was expelled. Basically, his wife and children actually tried to leave with him. No restrictions were placed on them, but they could not assimilate into the outside world, and they left and went back to New Square, New York. That's where this is. And went back, and he has his wife, ex-wife now. They did manage to get a divorce, but she won't let him have any contact with his kids. And so I think his daughter was recently married, and he wasn't allowed to even, you know, have any say in who she was marrying or go to the wedding, which was really sad. And so I was very sad when I read this book. It was good because he made discoveries about himself, but all of these discoveries, and it was very brave, but all these discoveries, you know, came at such a price. He lost his family. So I was very sad, you know, when I read that, but I hope that everything continues to go well for him. He's getting some international acclaim because of this book, which just came out last week. And but anyway, that was what I read, and I was very floored by that. It was actually a very well-written book, and I like books with good grammar. I'm sorry, I'm a grammar snob. I can't help it. Very good grammar without being overly stilted. And so when books have that kind of writing, that always jumps out at me for whatever reason. I really liked it. I read it on Kindle, and it was fantastic. And that's it, finally.
All right.
Woohoo. Now we get to talk about... Or should we go to the news first? Or do you want to do the book
first?
Oh, yeah. You know, I had a very... sad experience with news. Sir Terry Pratchett, renowned fantasy author, dies at age 66.
Yes.
Aww. I knew that he was going to die soon, I guess, because he had Alzheimer's, and I did know that. The Australian radio show All in the Mind did interviews with him a few years ago where they talked about how his Alzheimer's influenced his books. And, you know, because he writes the Discworld, or wrote, I should say, the Discworld books. They are very wacky, funny, humorous, fantasy-ish, science fiction-ish type of books. And a lot of people wonder, well, where do you start reading him? They don't build on each other that much. So if you don't start with the beginning of the series, you're okay. I started in the middle. I did read the first book. I've read several, but just kind of like throughout. And, you know, we read Hogfather, which is part of the Discworld series, but, you know, you don't have to, it was not the beginning book, and we were totally fine. We read that in a couple of Christmases ago, I believe. Not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before. So anyway, Sir Terry Pratchett has died at age 66 of Alzheimer's disease, and he'll be missed. Fans of Discworld have put together a petition to petition Death, who is one of the Discworld characters, to bring him back, which I think is funny.
That's so great. Such a great tribute.
Isn't it, though? I agree. I don't have much more to say about that other than we're not going to get any more Discworld books because of that. I will put some links into the show notes for these stories, and also for some interviews that you can hear taken from the Australia Radio National Broadcasting Network with Sir Terry Pratchett. Now, Apple, there's a new biography of Steve Jobs, to switch gears. And it's getting a lot more praise from Apple than the Innovators book received. Steve Jobs' autobiography by Walter Isaacson. He wrote a book called The Innovators, and that's what I was mixing them up. But he wrote a book that basically outlined some of the sort of less savory aspects of Steve Jobs' character.
I think this is a fascinating story because it didn't really seem like From what I haven't read the Walter Isaacson book, although I know that, that a bunch of people that I respect who have read it and say that it's very good.
I enjoyed it, but...
But I, like, was it really, like, about how what a terrible person Steve Jobs was?
No, it was not. It was not.
Yeah.
It just, it. I mean, there were some things in it that talked about, like, his business decisions that may not have been so great. And I think it actually was very praiseworthy of him in a certain sense, because it talked about how he started out of his garage. I mean, he came up from nothing. And it focused on that. And I don't really get what they're saying is so, like it says here, the Walter Isaacson book did a tremendous disservice to the Apple chief, said Tim Cook in his new book, written by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli, I believe. And it was this was excerpted in the April issue of Fast Company. Quote, "It didn't capture the person," Mr. Cook said. "The person I read about there is somebody I would never want to work with." And it did. I mean, it captured him as kind of a controlling person, kind of a control freak, which by all intents and even his own admission, he was.
He was.
So I don't quite get it. Johnny Ive, Apple's longtime design chief, added his criticisms of Mr. Isaacson's biography last month. Did I say autobiography a few minutes ago? I'm sorry. I meant biography. In the New Yorker profile, his regard couldn't be any lower for the book, noting that he had read only parts of it. Well, don't just read.
That was sort of the part that made me go, okay.
Did y'all really read the book?
Or did somebody just highlight the bad passages?
Yeah.
And be like, no, you have to read this part. Look at this.
And so, yeah, I know. And so the new book is being touted by another Apple executive as the best portrayal to be released, becoming Steve Jobs' book. And he's basically says this has got it right. So Becoming Steve Jobs is the name of the book. So go out, look for it on iBooks. It's being recommended by the people who knew him best, apparently. I don't know. I haven't read it yet.
We don't talk about comic books very
No,
often because,
we don't. And yeah.
Because we're blind.
We don't talk about them. But DC's comic Batgirl triggered this like unlikely argument over sexism, and I thought it was kind of fascinating. So a comic book cover, it was the cover of the book, something that most comic book geeks fuss about, but it's normally not considered front page news. But a couple weeks ago, a limited edition version of an upcoming Batgirl issue ignited a fierce debate across social and traditional media. Comic book, let's see, comic book giant DC Comics decided to publish an edgy alternative cover for its Batgirl series that recalled one of the series' more popular narratives. DC Comics canceled Batgirl 41 variant cover after all of this. And I'm not really, the artwork in question depicted the menacing villain Joker smearing his trademark grin and with gun in hand across the face of a terrified and weeping Batgirl. It was one of 25 variants that DC Comics planned to release in June to celebrate the Joker's 75th anniversary. But of course, the publisher announced that it was not going to release that one. And I think, I mean, you know, Batgirl's always, I always see Batgirl as kind of like a superheroine. I don't know if she is, you know, routinely terrified and weeping of the Joker. I'm not sure, but I would think not. So yeah, I can kind of see why this would cause controversy.
I think, I don't know. It's one of those things where it seems like, dudes, it's okay. You can let this one go. they were saying in the article that there was a lot of outcry about free speech after they pulled the cover, with people, you know, saying that you know, the DC writers had been swayed by people clutching at pearls, basically. And I don't know. I think that me personally, if I were to read comic books, I don't, that would not be a cover that would make me go,
no,
yeah,
because if Batgirl's supposed to be the heroine, you would expect the cover to depict her in a heroine-ish pose.
Right.
I mean, you
right.
know, like using her Batgirl
whatever
bravery and resourcefulness, like I said, we don't do the comic thing, to defeat the Joker instead of being, you know, crouching in fear of him. But, I mean, they want to celebrate the Joker himself, so they want to celebrate his villainy, I guess. So that was the reason that they did that. Because, you know, it's the anniversary of the Joker rather than, you know, celebrating good over evil, basically, I guess. I don't know. I would think that if you were DC Comics, you would still want to portray your characters in the way that they're supposed to be on the cover.
Yeah.
So I think that for that reason, I would have said, this isn't what I want to see. You know, I'd rather see Batgirl doing her Batgirl things on the cover. The Joker can look all villainous and stuff, and maybe you would, maybe it would be better if, for instance, you saw Batgirl like combating him and being unsuccessful in some way on the cover. But terrified
but
and weeping,
weeping and
I, but not weeping and terrified. I think there would be a middle ground there that you could, you know, celebrate the fact that the Joker is like all, pardon me, but badass and everything, without having the hero or heroine cowering in fear. So anyway, all that aside, we're going to switch gears. And the last couple of stories are, well, really, it's really one story about Harper Lee. We talked about it last time. But since we read To Kill a Mockingbird last time, I thought I'd bring it up again as sort of a follow-up story. Alabama, based on someone suing on her behalf, someone sued on her behalf. I'm not sure who it was. They had standing, apparently. Maybe it was one of her doctors or something. I don't know. Brought a suit trying to get her book, you know, to Ghost Set a Watchman out from, you know, publisher's thumb, stating that it's been published contrary to her wishes and that there was some elder abuse going on. Apparently, the appropriate agency in Alabama that oversees these things closed the Harper Lee elder abuse investigation after about a month or 6 weeks of diving into it and interviewing Miss Lee herself, as well as employees at the nursing home where she's currently residing, and concluded, and also her agent and some other people, her family and some other people close to the situation, and concluded that there was no elder abuse, that she was on target with everything, knew what was going on, and wanted the book published. And I think that this wouldn't have been such a big deal if she hadn't been so reclusive for so many years. And this seems kind of like out of character for her now, but I can kind of understand why she would want it published. I mean, she knows that she's aging and getting older, and perhaps she wants her final, you know, legacy for Scout to be published. And I never interpreted it as, oh my gosh, she's being forced to publish the book. I just thought, wow, she's coming out of her shell a little bit, still the same Harper Lee, you know, not really wanting to do interviews about the situation, and not wanting any media attention, but ready to publish this book. And I think people were worried that because she is somewhat disabled and, you know, she's somewhat deaf after, you know, from aging and has some vision trouble, that that she was being taken advantage of, because perhaps her communication skills weren't as, you know, good as they had been before. That seemed to be where they were all coming from. And I guess the state of Alabama has determined that there's nothing like that going on. Oh, that's such a shame. But anyway, I won't get off on another rant. It's good to know. And good to know that we will see more from, you know, a grown-up Scout soon. I think it's supposed to come out in June or July of this year.
July,
I think.
Like, yeah.
And with that done, here we go with To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. So since I've read it before, let's start with you again. What did you think of the book?
Oh, I've read it before, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this is not a new book for either of us. I love it.
I do, too.
I've always loved To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's one of those books that I feel like every time I read it, I get something new out of it. I read it as a kid. I didn't wasn't forced to read it in high school. It was just one of those things that where like my mom told me that I should read it, and I took her recommendation to heart, and I read it, and I enjoyed it in high school for its own sake. I probably would have not enjoyed it so much if we'd had to analyze it for class. And then I read it again a couple of years ago, just on my own, and kind of finally realized that it was not so much a book about Scout as it was a book about Atticus, which sort of passed me by at the age of 15. And then this time I felt like I was really kind of seeing how ambivalent she was about this small town. Like, it's very much a nostalgic small town in some ways, but then also it's not.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, that too. I mean, it was the town where she grew up, and yet there were so many things about it that basically, I mean, it kept people insulated to a large extent from, that's kind of like the danger of small towns. They have their own sort of social structure, and what happens in a small town, it stays in the small town, and people don't get much interference from outside, and that can be good and that can be bad. And small towns can have obviously their good points and bad points, and I saw both of those kind of come through in the book. I kind of analyzed it from a different point, which was from sort of a legal historical perspective, after having read it once, you know, seen the movie, and then read it in school, and then read it again. When I started law school, I was actually had to read it for a class. It was kind of a long story, but before law school even started, I had to read it, and I read it again. And periodically since then, I've taken it up and read it a couple other times. And it's very sad. And, you know, her bitterness and sort of ambivalence about the way the whole trial turned out was something that came through for me. And also how Atticus was not able, you know, to change the outcome. Even though, you know, like you said, it's a book about Atticus, even though you could tell that he tried to, and her, you know, it's her observations. Of course, we're not seeing Atticus from Atticus's point of view, but, you know, how it really did take a toll on him. And I noticed that, I think, you know, like you, the second time I read the book, I just love the scenes, you know, when she's trying to go to school and trying to fit in with the other kids, and oh, she can read, and her teachers just don't know what to do with her. I just, you know, on a lighter note, I think that's great. I really just really did appreciate that. Also, in a way, the whole ending was just so sweet.
It really was.
There's no better word for it.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's a way in which the book could be improved upon. I mean, I know that in a lot of cases we see books and we're like, well, this was just too long. They said what they needed to say in far too many pages, or the book was too short, like I wanted more. But I really do think that there were reasons, and very good reasons, why all of the, you know, beginning stuff was in there, basically to show you the small town and how things worked in it. And the relationships were developed quite well between all of the children.
Yes.
And I thought that was a particularly sort of artful thing to do, to make it not seem like it was such a slow start to the book. You know, you had this relationship between Jem and Dill, and, you know, trying to play pranks on the recluse down the street, and Scout tagging along because, well, what else is she going to do? And all this, because she always follows her older brother around. So a lot of that was just really sweet, and I enjoyed that. And the whole, you know, the whole Boo leaving presents for them in the tree, and that was just, that was awesome.
Yeah, that's always been my favorite, one of my favorite parts of the whole, their gradual sort of relationship with Boo, and, you know, how that all kind of falls into place. And
yeah.
And then, you know, it ending with him finally coming out and saving Jem's life.
Yeah, and he's really not as scary as everybody thought.
Yeah.
So.
And then, you know, I don't know, I was thinking about children being innocent, you know, that being a thing that we like to say, but that's not always necessarily a good thing, because if you, like, look back at what they did to, like, try to lure Boo Radley out of the house, I mean, like, yeah. It's clearly they, like, it was pretty obnoxious.
I know. Absolutely. And it also, I mean, it goes to show you how the infamous rumor mill can create fear and evil where really fear and evil don't need to, you know, don't need to exist. I wouldn't say that they were evil, but like you said, obnoxious behavior towards the scary next door neighbor. It's kind of like, oh, we're not afraid of him. Let's lure him out of the house. And really, they're doing it out of a sense of fear of something that they don't know or understand. And right. So I thought that was really interesting the way that all developed. And in a way, the whole book is about that. People reacting, not just the kids, but the other people, the jury in the trial, for instance, reacting in ways contrary to what they would normally do as good, upstanding citizens because through fear of others and lack of understanding.
Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty open and shut case, you know, like very clearly he was not guilty. And, you know, I think that's what's really... But I mean, I can imagine that was an interesting book to read for a law school class, because you could sit there and be like, well, duh.
Yeah, I mean, like, there were so many errors in the jury selection. And I think if it were decided today, obviously there are other protections that are around today that were not around at the time that the book was written. Or I take that back. At the time the book took place.
Yeah, right?
And so, you know, there are other protections that would have ensured that that sort of thing would not have happened. And so from, you know, actually I reread the book after law school, after I'd, you know, been taught all this stuff and had a deeper understanding of all the flaws that happened in the trial and all of the ways in which those things, you know, would not have happened now. I don't know that at the time they would have been flaws, but now they would be, you know, like glaring denials of someone's rights. And
right. They would have had at least one black man on the jury.
Yeah. And the jurors would have been selected from a wider jury pool and, you know, just a whole, the trial actually would have been moved to a different place. It wouldn't have been,
it wouldn't have
happened there. And you know, all these sorts of things that would have ensured that this kind of discrimination would not have happened. But anyway, I get off on a ramble fest. I think that if you haven't read this book, you should certainly read it as soon as possible. It's one of those books that you will, I am sure, enjoy at least some of. And if possible, there are several versions in audio that are really good. One with Roses Pritchard and one with Sissy Spacek actually narrating it. And both of them are fantastic. And there's also one on Bard.
Well, there are two on Bard.
Oh, two?
Yeah.
Oh, and you can pick it up in Braille on Bard as well and on Bookshare and Audible. So
yes,
it's out there. That said, let's see, what are we reading next time?
So next time we were thinking that we wanted to read a Terry Pratchett book, but we didn't want to read another Discworld book because we did that however long ago that was, 15 or 16 months ago. So we picked Good Omens, which is a book that he wrote with Neil Gaiman, and basically the apocalypse is going to happen next Saturday, but there's an angel and a demon and they both kind of like it.
Wait a minute, what? I got this book a long time ago. I haven't read it yet. Good Omens, Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. What did you just say?
Oh, it's repeat, please. Like the apocalypse is going to happen. Like I think that the narration on Bard says it like this: like the apocalypse is going to happen next Saturday or next week or something like that. and they have this angel and this demon, or both. They both kind of like it here on planet Earth.
Oh, I thought you meant they liked the apocalypse.
No.
Oh, okay.
So they have to to try to stop it, but they you know, their wacky hijinks have ensued. And they have to find the Antichrist first.
Oh my God.
Because he was born, but he got switched at birth with
oh dear,
some other kid.
Yeah, this sounds like Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett coming together. Sounds like it's going to be fun.
It really is a fun book. I've read it years ago, so it'll be fun to revisit it again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome. So that is what we will read next time. We will try not to take such a long time between podcasts, and we'll be back probably in a month or so. Our contact information is the same. If you want to email us, you can email bhapodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at bookhoarders, and you can also leave a comment on the website at bhapodcast.com.
And if you want to contact either of us personally, you can tweet Aaron at Aaron Edgar, and you can tweet me at Bardsong, and
check out Shannon's blog, flightintofantasy.com.
Although I haven't updated it in forever again. So.
Yeah, and my blog that I'm trying to update, but it really hasn't been updated in a long, long time, eclecticstrand.com. And with all that said, we're going to put this baby to bed, and we'll be back next time with more fun and hijinks and Sir Terry Pratchett. Woohoo! See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
To contact the Book Hoarders, send email to bhapodcast@gmail.com. Follow Book Hoarders on Twitter. Call us at 520-81-BOOKS, 520-812-6657. And visit the website at bhapodcast.com.